Hi, I'm Daniel Vickers.
And this is Mick, the Doctor of Digital.
And welcome to Music 101. Music 101 is created and powered music itself and legendary icon in the music industry. Another week, another great episode. Genre jumping, the wild legacy of iconic cover songs.
Yes, and the covers escape the borders of genre, decade, and cultural zeitgeist, finding new artists to break new ground. From Elvis turning Big Mama Thornton's R&B scorcher into Rockabilly Rebellion to Aretha Franklin, transforming Otis Redding's Demand into a feminist anthem, the best cover versions don't merely imitate, they expand, exposing fresh layers of meaning and emotion. Cover songs serve as cultural bridges, carrying melodies across the seemingly impenetrable walls that separated country from pop, folk from rock, and blues from soul.
Indeed. And Mr. Mick, thank you so much for sharing your knowledge and wisdom to the world. Let's start at the beginning, Mr. Mick. How did cover songs function in the 1950s music landscape?
The 1950s cover phenomenon was fundamentally about distribution, isolation, and the silos and the segregated infrastructure of American popular music. Record distribution and the radio were divided into a silo of race records and mainstream pop stations, and the music industry operated under the assumption that those audiences would never overlap in the Democratic Party stronghold in the American South. Cover songs became the mechanism to transform the magic of music into a transformation through which songs cross these artificial boundaries. Elvis Presley's 1956 recording of Hound Dog represents the most famous and transformative example of this dynamic. The song was previously a 1953 R&B bestseller for Willie Mae Thornton. The famous mainstream songwriters, Lieber and Stoller, wrote the song hit that took on a rockin' new persona with this iconic smash by Elvis. It was the number one bestseller for 11 weeks, helped along by the equally popular flip side, Don't Be Cruel. Big Mama Thornton had recorded the original in 1952 as a raw, sexually charged blues number that hit number one on the R&B charts. Her version was pure power, a woman putting a no-good man in his place with vocal authority that could shake buildings. When Elvis took it on, he fundamentally changed what the song meant. He sped up the tempo, added rockabilly guitar, and transformed the sexual politics into something more playful and ambiguous. His version sold over 10 million copies. The reinterpretation was a transformation, but musically, what Elvis did was a genuine reinterpretation rather than a simple imitation. He heard possibilities in the song that reflected his own inclusive musical background, which was genuinely steeped in black gospel and blues traditions from growing up in Memphis. The example was musical transformation, and it was the economic system of capitalism that ensured artists profited massively in opening the door to innovation from all corners in the competitive world of popular entertainment. Chubby Checker's 1960 cover of the R&B version by Hank Ballard and the Midnighters, The Twist, offers a model of how covers functioned in this era. Dick Clark, the powerful host of American Bandstand, saw commercial potential in Ballard's 1958 B-side, which had achieved mild success, reaching number 28 on the charts. But rather than promoting Ballard's original, Clark contacted the Philadelphia-based Cameo Parkway label and commissioned an entirely new recording with Checker, a young singer Clark had worked with previously. This business decision transformed musical history. Checker's version topped the charts in August 1960 and became the only song to reach number one on two separate occasions, first in 1960, then again in 1962, spending a total of 25 weeks in the top 10. Ray Charles's 1960 interpretation of Georgia on My Mind demonstrates a third model of how covers operated in this transitional period. The genius of soul was innovative and realized he could capitalize on the great American songbook. It was a brilliant move. Hoagy Carmichael had written the song in 1930 as a Tin Pan Alley standard, sophisticated, urbane, and emotionally restrained in the manner of pre-war popular music. The song was written in 1930 by Hoagy Carmichael, the music, and Stuart Correll, lyrics. Correll wrote the lyrics for Hoagy's sister, Georgia Carmichael. However, the lyrics of the song are ambiguous enough to refer either to the state or to a woman named Georgia. Carmichael's 1965 autobiography, Sometimes I Wonder, records the origin a friend, saxophonist, and bandleader Frankie Trumbauer suggested. Why don't you write a song called Georgia? Nobody lost much writing about the South. Thus, the song is universally believed to have been written about the state. In conclusion, the 1950s established that cover songs could function as cultural translation devices, carrying melodies across economic and generational boundaries while simultaneously answering why capitalism invited innovation and profit from any daring artist willing to push the boundaries of contemporary music.
Mr. Mick, the 1960s seems like the decade when covers become vehicles for genuine artistic reinvention. What changed?
The 1960s represented a fundamental shift in how artists approach cover material. Instead of covering songs primarily for commercial access to siloed markets, artists began using covers to make artistic statements about genre, authenticity, and the possibilities of musical transformation. The folk music revival, the British invasion, and the emergence of soul music created an environment where covering a song became an opportunity to demonstrate your artistic vision rather than simply your vocal abilities. Peter, Paul, and Mary's 1963 recording of Bob Dylan's Blowin' in the Wind perfectly expresses this new dynamic. Although it has been described as a protest song, it poses a series of rhetorical questions about peace, war, and freedom. The refrain, "The answer, my friend, is blowing in the wind," has been described by commentators as impenetrably ambiguous. Either the answer is so obvious it is right in your face, or the answer is so intangible as the wind. In 1999, the song was inducted into the Grammy Hall of Fame. In 2004, it ranked number 14 on Rolling Stones magazine's list of the 500 greatest songs of all time. Dylan had released the original in 1962 on his album, The Freewheelin' Bob Dylan, as a stark acoustic protest song with rough-hewn lyrics and vocals that emphasize authenticity over polish. This was capitalism at its best. Dylan himself understood this dynamic and appreciated their role in building his reputation as a songwriter, even as he moved in increasingly experimental directions that left folk pop audiences behind. The groundbreaking Newport Folk Festival was not long in coming when Dylan went electric. The Beatles' 1963 recording of Twist and Shout shows how the British invasion transformed American R&B through the lens of British teenagers who worshipped American music. The Isley Brothers had recorded the original in 1962 with sophisticated vocal arrangements and polished production. The Beatles captured the dynamism that the Isleys projected in another of their hits, Shout. The twist, no pun intended, is that the Isleys themselves had reworked an even earlier song. In 1962, they had their hit with their seminal cover of the 1961 Top Notes, Twist and Shout. The record was produced at the time by up-and-coming staff producer Phil Spector. Spector was previously known as a singer with the group The Teddy Bears and their smash hit of 1958, To Know Him Is to Love Him. However, when songwriter Burt Burns, also known as Burt Russell, heard the final mix, he told Spector that he had messed up the song and predicted a quick demise for the single. The Beatles were mostly inspired by the Isley Brothers cover done a year later in 1962, and it's interesting to hear how the original differs from the Isley Brothers and then the famous Beatles version. In any case, there is a bit of trivia associated with the Isleys. During a 1964 tour, the Isleys recruited a young guitarist named Jimmy James to play in their backing band. James, who would later shot to fame under his given name, Jimi Hendrix, made his first recordings with the Isleys, including the single Testify, issued on the brothers' own Teaneck label. The Beatles stripped away sophistication and replaced it with raw energy. John Lennon recorded his vocal in a single take at the end of a grueling recording session. His voice shredded from hours of singing, creating a performance that sounded genuinely desperate and urgent. This wasn't about improving the original. It was about channeling the emotional intensity of American R&B through the lens of British working-class rock and roll. Johnny Cash's 1963 recording of Ring of Fire offers a completely different model of the cover phenomenon. June Carter had written the song in 1962 with Merle Kilgore, inspired by her conflicted feelings about falling in love with Johnny Cash while both were married to other people. The original version, recorded by June's sister Anita Carter for their album Folk Songs Old and New, was a gentle folk ballad with traditional country instrumentation. Johnny Cash transformed it into something cinematic and dramatic, adding mariachi-style horns that he had heard in a dream, speeding up the tempo, and singing with a conviction that suggested the Ring of Fire was less metaphor than literal description of consuming passion. Aretha Franklin's 1967 recording of Respect represents perhaps the most complete transformation of any cover in popular music history. Otis Redding had written and recorded the original in 1965 as a straightforward soul number about a working man demanding respect from his woman when he comes home from his job. It was released in 1965 as a single from Redding's third album, Otis Blue, Otis Redding Sings Soul, and became a crossover hit for Redding. The music in the two versions is significantly different, while a few changes in the lyrics resulted in different narrators around the theme of human dignity that have been interpreted by his commentaries on gender roles, relationships, and respect. When released in the summer of 1965, the song reached the top five on Billboard's Black Singles chart and crossed over to pop radio's audience, peaking at number 35 there. At the time, the song became Redding's second largest crossover hit after I've Been Loving You Too Long and paved the way for future presence on American radio. Redding performed the tune, Respect, at the Monterey Pop Festival. Cashbox described it as a rollicking, rhythmic, pounding romancer about a fella who wants his sweetheart to treat him with respect when he comes home. Redding himself acknowledged at Monterey the transformation, joking during the festival that "that girl stole my song," but saying it with genuine admiration for what Franklin had accomplished. Franklin's was the definitive interpretation that revealed the song's deepest possibilities. Originally demoed by Smokey Robinson and the Miracles, 1966, I Heard It Through the Grapevine, Marvin Gaye's later version is legendary. Still, it was Gladys Knight's urgent Motown cut that gave the song its first chart-topping success. Gladys Knight and the Pips, I Heard It Through the Grapevine, 1967, and it's a classy song that was also a hit for Creedence Clearwater Revival. Jimi Hendrix's 1968 recording of Bob Dylan's All Along the Watchtower demonstrates how covers could function as artistic conversation between masters. The song's lyrics, which in their original version contain 12 lines, feature a conversation between a joker and a thief. The song has been subject to various interpretations. Some reviewers have noted that it echoes lines in the book of Isaiah, chapter 21, verses 5 through 9. Dylan has released several different live performances, and versions of the song are included on some of his subsequent greatest hits compilations. Covered by numerous artists, All Along the Watchtower is strongly identified with the interpretation Jimi Hendrix recorded with the Jimi Hendrix Experience for the third studio album, Electric Ladyland, 1968. The Hendrix version, released 6 months after Dylan's original recording, became a top 20 single in 1968, received a Grammy Hall of Fame award in 2001, and was ranked 48th in Rolling Stones magazine's 500 Greatest Songs of All Time in 2004, 40th in the 2021 version. Dylan first played the song live in concert on the Bob Dylan and the Band 1974 tour, his first tour since 1966. His live performances have been influenced by Hendrix's cover to the extent that they have been called covers of a cover. The singer has performed the song live more than any of his other songs, with over 2,250 recitals. Dylan had released the original in 1967 on John Wesley Harding as a stark acoustic meditation with cryptic lyrics and minimal production. Dylan subsequently began performing the live using Hendrix's arrangement rather than his own, effectively acknowledging that Hendrix had found the song's truest expression. This represents the ultimate artistic generosity, recognizing that your song has transcended your own interpretation. Joe Cocker's 1968 recording of The Beatles, With a Little Help from My Friends, shows similar transformative power. The Beatles had written it as a jaunty sing-along for Ringo Starr, with a vaudeville-style arrangement and deliberately simple vocal approach. Cocker turned it into a blues rock marathon, stretching the tempo, adding horn sections, and delivering vocals that sounded like they were being torn from his body. His performance at Woodstock became one of the defining moments of the era. Cocker's physical contortions while singing suggested someone channeling forces beyond his control. Paul McCartney's response captured the transformation perfectly. It was just mind-blowing. Totally turned the song into a soul anthem. Also from 1968 is just about my favorite cover of all time, Vanilla Fudge, This was the 1960s, and I don't make these names up, recorded You Keep Me Hanging On. Some songs refused to stay in one box. You Keep Me Hanging On started life in 1966 as a Motown number one smash hit for the Supremes, built on that jittery telegraph-like guitar riff and Diana Ross's clip-exasperated plea, Set Me Free, Why Don't You, Babe? It was an anthem of frustration wrapped in Motown polish, a hit that showed Ross not as a wounded lover, but as someone demanding honesty. But the story didn't end there. A year later, Vanilla Fudge slowed it to a crawl, stretching the pop sheen into a psychedelic dirge, heavy with organ and anguish. Suddenly, the same words sounded like a bad trip, proof that Motown's craft could be demonstrated into pure rock theater. Two decades on, Kim Wilde revived it again, this time as glossy synth pop. Her icy, neon-lit version topped the U.S. charts in 1986, making the song one of the rare tracks to hit number one in three very different eras and styles. That's the mark of a great song. It doesn't just survive covers, it thrives on reinterpretation. You Keep Me Hanging On lives three lives, Motown soul, psychedelic rock, and 80s dance pop. And in each, it sounds exactly like the time it belongs to. Isaac Hayes represents the evolution of Stax Records from Memphis from a scrappy independent label to a sophisticated musical powerhouse. Hayes started as a session musician and songwriter, co-writing Sam and Dave hits like Soul Man and Hold On, I'm Coming with David Porter. But when Hayes stepped out as a solo artist, he revolutionized what soul music could be. His 1969 album, Hot Buttered Soul, took popular songs and transformed them into extended orchestrated masterpieces. His version of Walk On By turned a 3-minute Dionne Warwick hit into a 12-minute journey that redefined how soul music could approach melody, arrangement, and emotional expression. Hayes understood that soul music didn't have to be confined to the 3-minute single format. He could create albums that worked as a complete artistic statement while still delivering the emotional impact that made soul music so powerful. In conclusion, the 1960s established that cover songs were transformative interpretations revealing possibilities in the original material that even the artists at first hadn't fully recognized.
Mr. Mick, how did the 1970s change the relationship between covers and genre?
The 1970s represented the moment when genre boundaries became truly porous, with artists confidently moving between musical traditions that had previously been considered incompatible. Country artists discovered soul, soul artists explored country, and folk artists embraced rock production. Cover songs became the primary mechanism through which these genre experiments occurred, allowing artists to demonstrate their range while paying tribute to influences across stylistic divides. Janis Joplin's posthumous 1971 release of Me and Bobby McGee captures this dynamic perfectly. Kris Kristofferson had written the song in 1969 as a country folk ballad about transient romance and the freedom of the open road. Roger Miller recorded the first version, but it was Joplin who made it immortal. Janis's interpretation added blues rock energy, gospel-influenced vocals, and most importantly, her own life experience as someone who had genuinely lived the kind of freedom and loss the lyrics describe. Released on her album Pearl after her death from a heroin overdose at age 27, the song became her only number one hit and her signature recording. Kristofferson's response to Joplin's version reveals how songwriters understand that great performances can transcend the original composition. He said, "It was just stunning. I never wrote another song that touched me the way she sang that one." The tragedy of her death just weeks after recording added layers of meaning that Kristofferson could never have anticipated, but became inseparable from how audiences heard the song. Al Green's 1972 recording of the Bee Gees, How Can You Mend a Broken Heart, demonstrates how soul artists approach contemporary pop material. The Bee Gees had released the original in 1971 as a Baroque pop ballad with their characteristic harmonies and orchestral production. Green took the same song and transformed it into pure Memphis soul, slowing down the tempo dramatically, stripping away the elaborate production, and delivering vocals that suggested genuine heartbreak rather than theatrical performance. His version reached number one on the R&B charts and introduced the Bee Gees songwriting to audiences who had never heard the original. Bonnie Raitt's 1974 recording of John Prine's Angel from Montgomery shows how covers function to build songwriting reputations. Prine had released the original in 1971 on his self-titled debut album as a stark acoustic ballad about a middle-aged housewife dreaming of escape. This represents an important function of covers that extends beyond commercial success, the role of interpretive artists in building audiences for songwriters. Linda Ronstadt's 1977 recording of Roy Orbison's Blue Bayou exemplifies how covers could introduce classic material to new generations. Orbison had released the original in 1963 as a lush orchestral ballad showcasing his remarkable vocal range. 14 years later, Ronstadt took the same song and gave it a country rock arrangement that felt contemporary while respecting the original's essential character. Talking Heads' 1978 recording of Al Green's Take Me to the River represents one of the era's most audacious genre crossings. And in this case, what we have is the original from Green's 1974, which was gospel-inflected soul that make you want to testify. Talking Heads took that same song and filtered it through art rock sensibilities, adding angular guitar work, nervous energy, and David Byrne's distinctive vocal approach that suggested emotional distance rather than soul surrender. The result shouldn't have worked. Art rock intellectuals from New York covering a Memphis soul classic seemed like a recipe for disaster. Instead, it became a dance floor classic that demonstrated how New Wave could absorb and transform soul music while remaining true to its own aesthetic principles. Originally by Brinsley Schwartz, 1974, Elvis Costello, What's So Funny About Peace, Love, and Understanding, 1979, is Costello's fiery rendition, eclipsing the pub rock original and turning it into a punk rock anthem. Originally by The Crickets, 1959, The Clash, I Fought the Law, 1979, gave this rockabilly tune raw urgency, transforming it into a rebellious punk classic. While in between the two versions, in 1966, the Bobby Fuller Four had a hit with their version. In conclusion, the decade proved that musical innovation often occurs at the boundaries between established categories, with covers serving as the primary mechanism through which these boundary crossings occur.
Mr. Meg, from synth-pop reinvention to country tenderness, from arena rock anthems to soul-bearing farewells, what do recent years reveal about how much era reshapes a song to match its deepest emotions?
Soft Cell's Tainted Love, 1981, took a forgotten 1964 Northern Soul single by Gloria Jones and reinvented it for a new age. Stripped down to icy synths and Mark Allman's weary vocal, the song shed its dance floor exuberance and became a minimalist anthem of disconnection. In the early 80s, when alienation itself felt part of the cultural mood, Tainted Love defined the sound of the moment. Brenda Lee had first recorded Always on My Mind in 1972, but Willie Nelson's 1982 version gave the song its enduring home. With his conversational, slightly behind-the-beat phrasing, Nelson transformed a solid ballad into something deeply personal and timeless. His delivery carried a quiet regret that resonated far beyond country music, turning it into one of his signature performances and a modern standard. Prince originally wrote Nothing Compares to You for his side project, The Family, in 1985, but it took Sinead O'Connor's stark, vulnerable rendition to reveal its emotional power. Stripped of ornament, her piercing voice and the unforgettable video of her tear-streaked face created an intimate connection with listeners worldwide. It became an anthem of raw heartbreak and one of the defining ballads of the 1990s. Bob Dylan's 1973 original, Knockin' on Heaven's Door, was a sparse, elegiac song written for the soundtrack of Pat Garrett and the Billy the Kid. Guns N' Roses reimagined it in 1990 as a massive arena rock anthem, full of wailing guitars and Axl Rose's soaring vocals. Their version turned Dylan's gentle lament into a cathartic live staple, proving how easily a great song can move from folk elegy to rock ensemble. Dolly Parton wrote I Will Always Love You in 1974 as a tender farewell to her mentor, Porter Wagoner. Nearly two decades later, in 1992, Whitney Houston turned it into a powerhouse ballad for The Bodyguard. With that quiet a cappella opening and the full-throated crescendo that followed, Houston's version became one of the best-selling singles of all time. Dolly herself said, "When Whitney sings it, I just about lose my mind all over again." Nine Inch Nails' 1994 original Hurt was industrial and raw, but Johnny Cash, at 71, hit in 2002, transformed it into something devastatingly human. With Rick Rubin's sparse production and Cash's cracked, time-worn voice, the song became a meditation on mortality and regret. The stark video, filmed at his Tennessee home, made it feel like a farewell letter. Even Trent Reznor admitted, "That song isn't mine anymore." In conclusion, the great tradition of first-rate reinterpretations of classic songs continues up to the present.
Mr. Meg, what's the lasting significance of those John Crossing covers?
They demonstrated that great songs possess multiple potential lives, that genre boundaries are permeable rather than fixed, and that the best covers don't reproduce the original, they reveal possibilities the original hadn't fully explored. In conclusion, it is established that the greatest musical achievements often occur not in isolation, but in dialogue. Artists speaking across time, genre, and cultural context through the shared language of great songs that prove endlessly adaptable to new voices and fresh visions.
In dialogue indeed. And Mr. Meg, thank you so much for sharing your knowledge and wisdom to the world. The Yes People genre jumping through cover songs has always been one of music's most thrilling traditions, where artists step outside their comfort zones to reinvent familiar tunes in vividly unexpected ways. So, Mr. Mac, would you like to plug in something?
You bet. Write the book, grow your business. You can connect with me on GMIC, the Dr. Digital Smith PhD on LinkedIn. Listen to the podcast, the Dr. Digital Podcast, couple of volumes on Amazon that you can pick up, Burning America and On Track, Ian Hunter.
Yes, indeed, people. Let's support Mr. Meg, the Dr. Digital. And please do listen to our baby podcast, Mental Health 101. Mental Health 101 is great to empower our mental health awareness. So, Mr. Meg, thank you so much for your time.
Until next time, Deus Vult.
More to come, people. See you soon.